Welcome to the Daily Standard Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, all of those places. We continue to think of the most interesting people to talk to around here. And one of the people who was right at the top of my list joins me today, Jerry Taylor, who is the president of the Niskanen Center and a recovering libertarian. So first of all, Jerry, thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me.
And are you okay with the recovering libertarian title?
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I've got a little bit of post-traumatic stress syndrome, but I'm doing fine.
No, I want to talk about that and what you're doing. But you know, since we're talking today, I'm sitting trying to puzzle through the Republicans all deciding that now is the time to recognize that Steve King is a racist and needs to be punished or ostracized. And I guess the question that I have that's running through my mind is, why now? What took so long for them to realize this? Because it wasn't as if we didn't know who Steve King was before the election, when all of the folks that are on television now denouncing him were completely okay with appearing in ads, going to rallies with him. You got any thoughts on this? Why the Republicans have finally gotten around to doing something about the white nationalist in their midst?
Yeah, who knows why the permission slip suddenly went out? I'm not entirely sure. I mean, anybody who's been paying attention knows that this man is a stone cold racist and has been for more than a decade. My guess is that it is finally occurring to the Republican Party that there are more costs than benefits of playing with that world and playing with that rhetoric. And the midterms kind of jolted them into a bit of reality on that front. And so now they're doing a little bit of house cleaning.
Yeah, unfortunately, it takes an election to jolt them into reality on something like that. I also think that it's somewhat ironic that, again, they're doing the right thing. I want to make it clear that I'm not criticizing them. I mean, better late than never sometimes. But there is a certain amount of virtue signaling going on in a party that is still headed by a guy that is now citing Pat Buchanan in his tweets. I do think this is kind of an overlooked, you know, you and I are old enough to remember who Pat Buchanan is, what he has become. And the president of the United States is now tweeting out Pat Buchanan, and it's almost like not the top five stories of the day. Actually, it's not the top 10 stories of the day.
Yeah, well, first of all, let's give virtue signaling its due. It's about time the Republican Party signaled a little bit of virtue somewhere along the line. So I don't think that we should just hand wave that. It's a good thing.
No, I agree.
As far as Pat Buchanan is concerned, I don't know about you, Charlie. I've known Pat on and off for several decades now. He is sort of the warm and cuddly face, if warm and cuddly could possibly be applied to this kind of paleo-conservative alt-right nationalism. He is a very friendly and charming guy.
Yes, yes.
In a way that Steve King most certainly isn't. So it's a matter of Buchanan delivered the same message, roughly speaking, but in a far more amazing to say this, but a little bit more of a genteel fashion than Steve King does, where there's absolutely no gloss on it whatsoever. But yeah, look, this is Pat Buchanan's party today. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, and you know, he's become less and less subtle about this. And in fact, I was looking at the article that Trump tweeted from, and Buchanan again is he's not pretending what his position on immigration is about. This is what he writes: the more multiracial, multiethnic, multicultural, multilingual America becomes, the less it looks like Ronald Reagan's America, the more dependably democratic it will become. The Democratic Party is hostile to white men because the smaller the share of the U.S. population that white men become, the sooner the Democrats inherit the national estate. The only way to greater diversity, in quotes, the golden calf of the Democratic Party, is to increase the number of women, African Americans, Asians, and Hispanics, and thereby reduce the number of white men. Well, whoa.
You know, what's really amazing is that if you go underneath that rhetoric, what you have is this implication that human dignity is primarily driven by which party you're going to vote for. Mm-hmm. This is, to me, just absolutely amazing. I mean, you wonder if any of these people have ever met a Democrat in their life. I don't know about them, but in my own family and circle of friends, I know people who are Republicans. I know people who are Democrats. I know people who are Elizabeth Warren supporters. My father, if he were still alive, would be wearing a MAGA hat. And I'll tell you what, the human worth And the rights that people have are not primarily dictated by what they do in the ballot box. But you get this idea out of the Republican Party today that if you vote for Donald Trump, then you have great moral worth. And if you do not, you're human garbage and your rights are attenuated and all bets are off as far as your freedoms and dignities in this country. It's really amazing. So in other words, if those women coming from Guatemala and El Salvador who are desperate for asylum in this country had a MAGA card in their purse, I imagine they might be treated differently by this administration than the fact that they lack said card.
Yeah, obviously. Also, there is the alternative political view, which is that if, in fact, there are more African-Americans, Asians, Hispanics, and women, that the task of the Republican Party is to convince them to vote for them. That would actually believe in persuasion, as opposed to believing apparently that the identity makes them absolutely unpersuadable, that they will always be Democrats, so let's keep them out as much as possible. It really is extraordinary. Now, I mentioned before we started the podcast that I have a piece that you wrote here in front of me, and for our listeners who are going to look up, like, what is the Niskanen Center all about? Who is Jerry Taylor? You are still on various websites described as a libertarian activist. But I think one of the most interesting things that has happened with, well, I think it's happened to a lot of folks on the right, certainly it's happened with me on the right, but you've really laid out your ideological transition away from libertarianism. And so let's talk about that first rather than, and I don't want to jump to where you are right now, but let's just talk about, you spent decades of your life as a libertarian and are no longer one. Why not?
Well, yeah, I spent more than 20 years working at the Cato Institute, which is the citadel of Orthodox libertarianism, eventually rising to one of the several vice presidents they have there. But I began to lose faith in those Orthodox libertarian creeds. And that's primarily because, not that I walked away from the idea that individual liberty and autonomy is something worth fighting for and embracing in public policy. I still believe that. But how do you define it? So, for instance, a lot of libertarians believe that freedom and liberty is simply a matter of government leaving you alone. The less government you have, the more freedom you have. I mean, that's been the narrative in American politics, even from the left, for a very long time. But the reality is that government, modern social democracies, exercise their power primarily to enhance liberty and autonomy. So, for instance, during the 1964 Civil Rights Act, there were conservatives, including Barry Goldwater at the time, who argued that it's an infringement on liberty if the government tells a restaurateur that they have to serve black customers mm-hmm. at the lunch bar. And it certainly is. I mean, in a sense, if you have freedom of association, then you're infringing it with that kind of power. Are we less free because the government passed the 64 Civil Rights Act and required private restaurateurs and other businessmen to treat people equally, regardless of their race? I don't think so. I mean, today the South is freer by virtually every sane metric than it was in the 1950s. Why? Because of the exercise of government power. And in my mind, where libertarianism has gone wrong is it has forgotten the fact that a lot of private action can indeed have terrible negative consequences for individual liberty and autonomy. If you look around the world where you see the least amount of government, you know, the dream for libertarians is the least amount of coercive power, taxation power, and whatnot equals a world of autonomy and freedom. When you look around the world to find states like that, they're called failed states. And how much freedom and liberty autonomy really is held in Pashtun Afghanistan or in Somalia or in any of these failed states? Very little in any functional way. And so my march out of Orthodox libertarianism was primarily based on the fact that their own definition of freedom and liberty and autonomy is not particularly compelling for politics today.
Yeah, you write, for instance, in my old circles, libertarians will argue passionately against the state, but marshal little evidence about what sort of society might actually arise in the modern world were the state to largely disappear. Perhaps the most impressive intellectual ever to take up the libertarian cause, Robert Nozick, had absolutely nothing to say about that in Anarchy, State, and Utopia, which you described as your Bible for most of my adult life. And what the line that really struck me was when you said that there's a reason for the omission, because wherever we look around the world, when we see inconsequential governments with limited power, as libertarians would prefer, we see failed states. How much liberty and human dignity can be found there? Very little. That's a very, I think, trenchant critique.
Well, thank you, Charlie. One of the things that really illustrates that well, as I mentioned in the essay, was an episode of The Sopranos, which I was a big fan of. And there was an episode where, for those of you who are fans, this may resonate, a somewhat elderly academic sort of fellow witnesses a crime in New Jersey and knows nothing about who the perpetrator is or whatnot. He goes to the police like he's supposed to and reports the crime. And the scene has that man, after he does so, sitting in his living room reading Robert Nozick's Anarchy, State, and Utopia, kind of looking rather tweedy and professorial. And while he's reading this in the evening, the phone rings and it's his lawyer. And his lawyer tells him that the person he just fingered was Tony Soprano, a mob boss in New Jersey. And the man turns white and hangs up the phone, immediately calls the police and retracts everything. It was a tremendous narrative about what a world in which government can't protect you from predators might look like. It's not going to look like Ayn Rand's Galt Gulch. It's not going to be a utopia of individual liberty and freedom. It's probably going to be a world in which mob bosses like Tony Soprano reign supreme. And or in other parts of the country or other parts of the world where religious factions reign supreme, like in some parts of the Middle East, or where castes reign supreme, like in India or in the American South. Places where human dignity and liberty are not exactly shining examples for mankind.
Well, your piece is entitled The Alternative to Ideology. So let's define what you mean by ideology and how it has played out on the right, particularly the libertarian right. What do you mean by ideology?
Well, you know, it's interesting because ideology means different things for different people. What I think is the best definition is the idea that all of your pursuits in politics should be managed to achieve one particular objective. So for libertarians, that's individual freedom and liberty, right? That's libertarians look at every public policy and say, well, is this policy going to maximize individual freedom and liberty or isn't it? And if it does, they support it. If they don't believe it does, they'll oppose it. On the progressive left, it might be social justice or equity. Is this policy going to lead towards those ends or not? And if it does, they embrace it. If not, they oppose it. And conservatives might look at community or something like that. So socialists may look at it. Does this maximize worker say over economic behaviors? The problem here is that the world is too complicated for any one consideration to reign supreme at any and all times. There are a lot of things that we are concerned about in American politics or ought to be. So, for instance, I'm very concerned about individual liberty autonomy and always have. But I also understand that social justice does mean something, particularly given the civil rights history in the United States or the way we've treated the American Indians or the way we've treated women in this country. These are not irrelevant or passing considerations. They do count. Pluralism and the right to for people to believe things differently than from what I believe. Those things count, too. Community does count. If you destroy the bonds of community and society, you probably get a world that doesn't look all that much different from the one we have today. So it's not irrelevant to have the kind of strong communal bonds that animate people like George Will or David Brooks. All of these things are important considerations, but in each policy arena, you can't have them all at the same time. And whether you're going to weigh your policy to achieve social justice or individual liberty autonomy or the health of the community really is contingent upon what issue you're talking about and what are the historic circumstances. It's not an easy thing. So in other words, I can't use some sort of algorithm to tell me what the right policy is in any particular arena simply because I believe in individual liberty or autonomy or simply because I believe in social justice and the reduction of inequality in the United States. All those things are important, but they're not reliable guidelines for public policy. And ideologues tend to go into these discussions with one objective primarily in mind, others that are secondary, and they already seem to know the answers before the questions are even asked. And to me, that's what ideological governance is. And it is, in almost all circumstances, a very bad thing.
So do you think of yourself as a Burkean?
One could. I mean, if we were to have a discussion about how to label people like me at the Niskanen Center, you could be all over the map. You could fit these kind of observations in with Burkean.
Well, I'm suggesting Burkean as an alternative to, say, rhino. Right. Yeah, I mean, if you had maybe to choose, I'm a Burkean.
I don't mean to digress for a minute, but it's so ironic to hear Trumpists use the phrase, or the modern Republican Party talk about rhinos. I mean, the Republican Party is the party of Lincoln. It's the party of civil rights. It's the part. Progressivism was born in the Republican Party by Teddy Roosevelt. And what happened was the Republican Party was taken over by Southern Democrats around 1964. So it's like Visigoths taking Rome and then trying to out-Roman the Romans and say who's a proper Roman or not. This Republican Party today is the Democratic Party, the Dixiecrat South. So I don't want to hear any more about Rhino from this crowd. These are the Visigoths. They're not the native inhabitants of the party.
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, the fact that Donald Trump was literally the Republican in name only, the guy who'd spent his entire life either as a Democrat or a reform member of the party, was giving money to Hillary Clinton and all of this. And I mean, he was the rhino. So, yes, irony has been beaten to death by hammers in our age. So back to the question about ideology. You argue that the alternative to ideology is what you describe as moderation. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question is, we do not seem to live in a very moderate time. And at least I am not seeing right now either political party moving toward, even though you would have, you know, I would think a constituency for it, the trend lines are not toward moderation. So what do you mean by moderation?
Well, by moderation, I have in mind a couple of things. First of all, the idea that that all of the value considerations we hold in American politics, as I mentioned before, have merit and are worth embracing under certain contexts and considerations. And there's no one particular driver that should inform our policy. And that, in a sense, is formal, in a way, moderation. Secondly, there is a limit to our possible ambitions in public policy. Even if you disagree with me and say, no, government really ought to be about promoting individual liberty, autonomy above and beyond all of the things, that's all well and good. And about 5% of the American public agrees with you, according to the surveys that I've seen about the strength of the libertarian vote. So what are you going to do about the other 95%? You can say, well, we're going to persuade the other 95%. Well, how's that gone? They haven't done a very good job of it. And it turns out that, look, when we're talking about ideology, we're really talking about personal values that we bring into the political realm. And they are not going to be changed because of a great essay in National Review or The Wall Street Journal. These things have been, there have been disagreements about the aims of public policy from time immemorial. And so moderation is about respecting pluralism in society and allowing the fact that not everyone's going to agree with you. You're never going to persuade them. So how can we all live together in the same country from border wall fence to border wall fence and ocean to ocean without tearing each other's throats out? And in my opinion, while this is not an era of moderation, I think the collapse of the American center and the increasing bitter and toxic hyperpartisanship is already beginning to drive an interest into a return towards, if not normalcy, in the world in which we can live together without necessarily going to the brink of civil war. And I think that's where we're increasingly flirting ourselves politically today. And I think that there is a room for moderation in a post-Trump America.
You remind me of something that I heard you say at a meeting we were at in San Francisco. It was a super secret meeting, so we're not going to describe it. But you went through those numbers. Basically, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was an incredibly small number of Americans who, in fact, were ideologically committed, you know, either way. And that's sort of your point here, is that we're debating with on a very, very, you know, sort of thin edge. The vast majority of Americans are not engaging in these debates, are not ideologues who are in these little, you know, rigid intellectual prisons.
No, that's absolutely right. And in fact, one of the downsides of spending as much time as I've spent talking about the pitfalls of ideology is that, in a sense, it's almost not the right complaint to offer about American politics today. If you look at people who identify as conservatives or liberals or progressives, those who proudly don those labels, and then you examine what public policies they hold dear, you would think that if you're a conservative, that means you're pro-gun rights and you're anti-abortion and you're for tax cuts. And, you know, we can all go through it. Same thing on the left. It turns out there's virtually no correlation whatsoever with ideological self-identity and the positions people hold. Now, that should really tell you something. It turns out that most people who say I'm, you know, a conservative or a liberal, or they talk ideologically, it's not that they believe in certain core principles. It's that they're really hyper partisan. So, I mean, it's like wearing a Letterman's jacket for your political team. So if you're a Republican, you want to say, man, I am so Republican. Well, that's because I am a true blue conservative. Or if you're on the left, I'm a progressive. That just means you're really, really with the party because the party are for, you know, as you understand it, these things. But the reality is very, very few people have very well thought out, considered, or consistent views about American politics. Political scientists have known that for a long time. The number is vanishingly small in the American public. They tend to go where the party takes them. So the problem in America today really isn't excessive ideological thinking. We have very little ideological thinking in this country. It's excessive partisanship and the degree by which people will follow the leader in their party. Almost, I shouldn't say blindly, but they're very lightly engaged in politics. They decide who has the right intentions or who's fighting for people like me. And then they adopt whole cloth what those positions might be, even if it's a complete reversal of positions they had 4 years ago or 6 years ago or even a year ago. And we've seen that in public polling data over and over again.
Yeah, this is I think the central point is that guys like you and me, we've spent years thinking that politics was about ideas and was about these principles, was about programs, when in fact, for most Americans, politics is about identity. It's about attitude. It's about that loyalty to the party or to the tribe. So maybe we should not have been so surprised to watch them, completely reverse themselves on one issue after another, if in fact that's the way the party goes. So we can't have this conversation without talking about climate policy, because this is something that you have written very, very extensively about, and which obviously puts you crosswise with much of the conservative movement. So let's just go back to the beginning of, as a libertarian at the Cato Institute, when did you start thinking about, whoa, what are we going to do about climate policy?
Well, when I was first hired at the Cato Institute in 1991, I believe it was, I was hired to be the director of energy policy, and then I took over the environmental portfolio about 2 years later. So for the bulk of my time there, I was in charge of all of the issues dealing with energy and environment, and climate change was increasingly the number one issue in that field. And so for a little bit more than a decade or so, I offered what is the kind of conservative line, or at least the more intelligent conservative line, which is that climate change is real, it's happening, CO2 does indeed warm the planet, but it turns out that it doesn't warm the planet near as much as the model suggests it might, that the climate is less sensitive to anthropogenic CO2 emissions than we believe, and that warming will probably be at the very, very low end of the possible distribution of outcomes. Its effect will be very modest. Oh, and by the way, the cost of doing something about this modest amount of warming that we're likely that's likely in our future would be staggering. It would require an economic revolution that would have very high costs, and there are opportunity costs for that. Even if you could say, well, it's still probably on balance more benefits than costs in trying to transition away from fossil fuels, what else could we do with that revenue? Could we attack global poverty? Could we attack AIDS? And there are all these things which have larger body bag counts than what we're seeing in climate change, which would demand those resources. So that was the narrative I offered for more than a decade. And parts of that were fairly reasonable positions to hold in the early 1990s or mid-1990s. But as time has gone on, a lot of those narratives fell apart. It turns out that climate change is a much more significant threat than we had realized, or at least that I had realized at that point. The green energy revolution has dramatically reduced the cost of transitioning away from fossil fuels. But the very first thing that caused me to seriously reconsider my position was the increasing reality of what I discerned, which is that the scientific narratives that were being peddled on the right were complete hogwash. And, look, none of us have a great deal of incentive to do really strict due diligence for things we want to believe or for things which our friends and colleagues are promoting who look like credentialed experts, right? Mm-hmm. So if you read a study that says gun control will be ineffective because, for various different reasons, and you're in favor of gun control, you're probably not going to do the same amount of examination of that study as you would if you saw a study that concluded the contrary and you felt like
we all engage in confirmation bias.
Yeah, there's confirmation bias. And so I remember there was a debate in which I offered this sort of narrative about the climate models, and I argued that it had been more than a decade since James Hansen testified in front of the United States Senate in the late 1980s, and he argued that if we continue on a business-as-usual path, we're going to see a dramatic amount of warming, and he gave a projection. And now it's been more than a decade. We can look back on that projection and see that we've only warmed about a quarter as much as Hansen says we should have, which tells me the models are, running too hot and the climate's not as sensitive to CO2. as we had thought. And so I got done with this program, and I was debating a guy at the time who happens to be a scientist. And we go into the green room, and he says, "Did you even read Hansen's study before you loaded that BS on the show?" And I said, "Yeah, I had. It's been a while, but." And he says, "Let me tell you what's wrong with what you go back to your office and you read that study again. Here's what you're going to find. What you said," he said, "was strictly speaking correct, but you know the main reason he was off is because he was wrong about how much industrial emissions we were going to see in the future." He gave this testimony in 1988. It was before the Montreal Protocol was signed, which took a lot of greenhouse gases out of the portfolios. And we've had a surge in natural gas production, and we've had a couple of other natural events. He said, so he was wrong, you're right, but he was wrong because he grossly overestimated the amount of greenhouse gases we'd be putting in the atmosphere. He did give a couple of other scenarios, Jerry, one of which tracked the emissions profile since that testimony over the next decade or so very closely. And he said, and he also gave a temperature projection for that scenario. And it turns out that temperature projection is pretty much spot on. He said, so when you say, oh, the models are running hot or the atmosphere isn't as sensitive as you thought, that is complete crap. That is complete crap. And he says, so go back to your office and tell me I'm wrong or just be a hack and don't bother. So I went back to my office, found out that he was right. And then I went to my colleague who was a climate scientist and, you know, somebody who actually publishes in this field every once in a while. Told him what had happened. I said, what am I missing here? Because it seems to me that he's right. And it turns out I was missing absolutely nothing. He was right. And the scientist basically argued that he's not James Hansen's lawyer. And in fact, that's the very phrase he uses. Let him defend himself. And I was shocked because I didn't think that my side in this debate was playing fast and loose and disingenuously. But it turns out they were. And
so this is fascinating to me because what you're describing is something that we really don't have a lot in our politics today, which is somebody who goes out and says something forcefully in public is then pushed, gets pushback, and then determines that, in fact, they were wrong and is willing to admit they were wrong. That seems very anachronistic, Jerry.
Well, it is in a way, because look, most people in public policy aren't in the business of persuading the other side. They're in the business of being the very best proponent for their point of view amongst other people who might be those proponents mm-hmm. on Fox News or in the Wall Street Journal or whatnot. So they're talking to their crowd and they're trying out to be the very best table pounder there might be. And my ambition when I was at Cato was a little different. I wanted to actually prove that my arguments were stronger than their sides. And I wanted to do that by debating the best and the brightest on either side and wrestling those arguments to the ground in front of people who may not have been on my side, but to show them that I was right and the other side was wrong. Most people in policy don't do that. That's just not what they do. You can tell that by Tucker Carlson is not trying to persuade you of anything, right? He's holding his line. Nobody goes into watching Tucker Carlson, who's somewhere else or a little bit of agnostic. You know, is he going to appeal to? Because he insults the viewers all the time and, you know, people hold different points of view. So because of that ambition I had, I was interested in understanding the other side's arguments as well as, if not even better than they did. And when it comes, and I also felt like I had a responsibility. I knew journalists like John Stossel and George Will, who aren't climate specialists, but they would reach out to me and other colleagues of mine at Cato to know, you know, what the narratives are that they should be writing about in their columns. In other words, they were outsourcing their analytics to us. So I felt like I had a responsibility to them and not to let them say stupid things or inaccurate things or misleading things, to give them the best arguments I could to make sure they're on solid ground. And so if I'm in the business of consciously promoting, you know, disingenuous information, it's not just my own reputation or the fact that smart people will be listening to me and rolling their eyes and considering me either a liar or an idiot, but I'm also going to leave other friends of mine on the scaffold and hung in public. And I didn't think that was, I thought that would about the worst thing I could possibly do is betray the trust of people, you know, these columnists who I was dealing with, giving them bad information.
But that means you're a heretic then. You become a heretic.
Well, it is. You know, it's what on the right, as you might well know, Charlie, if you part company on climate change, that's about the biggest apostasy you could engage in, besides maybe parting company on abortion.
Yeah.
On the right now, one thing that the climate skeptics and denialists have done very well is they've elevated climate denialism and skepticism as a core tribal identity matter for Republican conservatives. So at Niskanen, we might argue for a wealth tax or for a more robust social safety net and social insurance. And it's not going to annoy conservative donors that I might be talking to anywhere near as much as saying, hey, you know what? Al Gore was pretty much correct about climate change. No matter how you feel about Al Gore, generally speaking, the narrative he offered was right. Well, that is going to drive the right nuts more than just about anything else you could possibly say, even though the question of whether climate change is real or not, whether it's a serious risk or not, has nothing to do with ideology, nothing to do with
how you... So how did it happen? This is an interesting point. You're absolutely right. You know, you could propose, you could talk about the social safety net, you could talk about, you know, whether you favor or don't favor a value-added tax, and people will disagree with you, and, you know, we'll discuss the upside and the downsides of the issue, but there are certain issues that are the bright red line. So how did this become so tribal? Because it is obviously a matter of you know, scientific fact and public policy, right? So, I mean, how did it become this identity issue? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, the people that I had worked with when I was on the other side of this debate were primarily engaged in raising the saliency of climate change on the right to make it a fighting issue. And they've succeeded very well. And the way they've done that is to portray people who want to address climate change as fundamentally hostile to capitalism, yeah, hostile to humanity, people who wish there would be a major population die-off so that the bunnies could grow in population without being bothered by mankind, that these are internationalists who don't care about America or American workers. They have so demonized those who are concerned about climate change based on what their motives allegedly might be, that they have turned climate activists into the primal anti-Western actors in American politics.
I think you're right, and as somebody that's been part of that movement, I have to admit, I'm just, you know, look back at some of the things that I'm sure that I've said and written about this with a good deal of embarrassment, because of course I'm not a scientist. I mean, what did I know? All I knew was that that every week or so I got a big package from the Heartland Institute that mocked the issue, and you know, back in the day, I trusted certain folks that I think have turned out to be, you know, very, very unreliable. But that's the way it has played out. And of course, there's that moment when you start to ask yourself, well, what if I'm wrong about all of this? And then the implications are, well, if you're wrong about all of this, you're basically self-excommunicating yourself from the movement. So let me ask you this, Jerry. How do you describe yourself right now, or the Niskanen Center, if you want to go with it? Because, you know, obviously, you know that you are going to be accused of being now a, you know, a rhino, a Republican in name only, which you've already addressed. So how do you describe where you fit, if any place, on the ideological spectrum?
You know, labels are tricky things. I'm comfortable with the moderate label. Moderation in the GOP is the creed of Dwight Eisenhower and Gerald Ford Nixon.
Would you call yourself an Eisenhower Republican?
Oh, probably, but I might even go more left and say I'm a Nelson Rockefeller Republican just to make the conversation interesting. But not everyone on my staff is there. You know, there you could make an argument that what we're really talking about is Oakeshott conservatism. But unfortunately, it's a brand of conservatism that is nowhere to be found in the United States. One can argue this is kind of Millsian liberalism, actually, which would maybe, you know, sometimes Mills is looked at as a libertarian icon, but for the most part, he tends to have traction on the center left of the Democratic Party. I really don't know. And I am kind of uncomfortable with labels and isms, mm-hmm, because, again, if you believe that an ideological compass is not the right way to go about American politics, and if you respect pluralism in the society, and you find that your main job as a political actor is to find rules that we can all, as a nation, and with all of our different idiosyncratic views, agree to live under the same roof with the same set of rules, so we don't tear each other's throats out. Mm-hmm. It takes out of the mix this idea of fundamentally remaking society, produce, say, a night watchman state or a social justice utopia or something like that. Those things are never going to be in the cards. So what is your ism? Well, it's one that holds the health and safety of the American Republic above all other things, almost, because without it, you know, we're creating towards a breakup and a near civil war in this country. And I can't imagine a worse outcome.
Well, let me tell you what I say behind your back, Jerry.
Oh, yeah.
or actually not totally behind your back, because you see what I say on Twitter as well, which is that you folks have been doing some of the most interesting, thought-provoking stuff that I think is on the right. Now, I don't necessarily know that I agree with everything. In fact, I'll often read and go, wow, that's a, you know, that's you know, that's not something that I'm sure that I can get on board with, but it is so thought-provoking. And I think in part it's because you sound liberated. Do you feel that way? It's like you've sort of broken the chrysalis and said, okay, you know, once we break free from all of these dogmas, it's actually kind of fun to be able to explore these questions. And I do think that that's what's making the Niskanen Center really kind of the centerpiece of what I've kind of described as this great rethinking that's been going on in conservative circles.
Well, thank you for that, Charlie. That's
I laid that on pretty. I laid that on awfully thick, and so you know, you can send the check later. But
yeah, it's very, very wise thoughts on your part. There is a lot to that, because when you're part of an ism or you're part of a partisan team, there's a lot of internal self-policing that goes on. That, you know, so for instance, if you're on the right and you're a free market capitalist, then Thomas Piketty comes along with his book, which says the returns to capital are greater than GDP, broadly speaking. You know, so what do you do with that? Well, you know that if you agree with Thomas Piketty, you are throwing in with a Marxist, you're throwing in with progressive leftists. That's not your job. And so immediately Piketty's book comes along, and you either decide to ignore it or you frantically decide to gain ammo to shoot back at it, as opposed to actually read it and maybe try to learn something and think for yourself. And so by shedding ourselves of these ideological or partisan boundaries, it is very liberating, because you're no longer playing that role of mobilizing your inner policeman to boundary your thoughts. And so there is a lot of creativity that can follow once motivated cognition is turned off. And you're allowed to let your mind and intellect go where you find it.
You know, you made so many good points there. I think back on all the times when I would have, you know, absorbed information, all the reading, really looking for ammunition, not necessarily looking for truth, because, you know, you're in a battle and you need to find what weapons are there. But that's a completely different process than stepping back and going, okay, I'm going to be open-minded about this. Is this possibly right? Where is he right? Where is he wrong? You know, maybe I should rethink and reconsider these positions, because, of course, in some ways that's scary, but then once you break out, it's actually incredibly liberating. Jerry, thanks so much. I've really been looking forward to having this conversation with you. Jerry Taylor is the president of the Niskanen Center, and I would strongly urge people to go and look at some of the recent publications. We've only touched on some of the things that you've come out with. I thought the discussions of the social safety net, not being an impediment to prosperity, but actually being very, very consistent with it. I thought that was really provocative. And, you know, as somebody who wrote a book called A Nation of Moochers, it really does force me to challenge some of the assumptions that I made. So, Jerry, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Charles, and keep up the good work.
And thank you for listening to the Daily Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.